Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Breitall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight number 191 for comics originally released on April 6, 2011. Starting us off in DC is Doom Patrol number 21. This one features pretty much the life history of Robot Man, which I've always found to be one of the more interesting Doom Patrol characters. And I thought they did a really good job here, giving kind of an overview of his life, kind of with his commentary on a lot of it. And I thought it fit well within the series overall. It was a nice kind of a breather issue. And, you know, if it wasn't for the fact next issue is the final issue, I'd almost say this is a good jumping on point.
Well, you know, I think what can be said is this is a good issue for anyone to pick up as a standalone issue. If you're interested in the character Robot Man, you can pick up and enjoy Doom Patrol number 21, and you don't have to have read. I mean, there are certain things you might not get, but, I mean, it's useful, you know, from that standpoint of, you know, who is Robot Man? And you don't need to read anymore if you don't want to. It is too bad that the series is ending. I think that Doom Patrol is, obviously a highly underrated series since it's one of the ones that's getting canceled due to low sales by DC. But I also think it's not the kind of title that is going to ever be, you know, a top-selling with the mainstream superhero fan.
Yeah, I think the odds of Doom Patrol ever being up near the top of the list is really, really low, and I'm trying to think of what kind of shenanigans they could pull to make that happen. And I'm thinking even top flight creators, cover gimmicks out the wazoo and stuff like that, it still would be a hard sell.
I think what the shenanigans that they would have to pull would make it not be Doom Patrol. You know,
yeah, that's fair. I mean, right now, issue
Doom Patrol featuring Green Lantern, Flash, and Batman, you know?
Yeah. The previous issue of Doom Patrol, issue 20, sold 9,386 estimated units through the direct market. So, yeah, not selling well, and not surprised that they're pulling the plug on this. But, you know, it says something that they've actually got a couple of titles set in the mainstream DC universe selling well under 10,000 units. And it doesn't matter how good we may think these titles are. And, again, I thought this was a really good issue in terms of a good entry point. You know, there was nothing wrong with this issue, but nobody, by and large, is buying the Doom Patrol. Nobody really bought the last two or three incarnations of the Doom Patrol. And in 3 or 4 years when they try again, odds are nobody's going to buy that one either.
Yeah. Nobody meaning, you know, not the massive crowd of people that are needed to make the title successful. I mean, it seems like almost any incarnation, although, except the John Byrne one, I never heard a lot of buzz about that one. I thought it was relatively decent, but John, you know, he takes a lot of flack, you know, does.
I got a question about that incarnation. Throughout this issue, there are a lot of really good splash pages of kind of the different eras of the Doom Patrol. And I really like those pages. And they've got one for the John Byrne era. And the caption is kind of, you know, as it turns out, it wasn't really Larry, it wasn't really Rita, and go figure, it wasn't really Cliff. And I'm like, so are they kind of dismissing or discounting that era of the Doom Patrol? I was confused.
Yeah, I think that they were. But, you know, I think any of these eras of the Doom Patrol that they have, you know, they have their fans, and they're very loyal fans. You know, like, you have probably the strongest following was for the Vertigo incarnation.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of people who liked the Vertigo incarnation. But even at that, it, you know, ultimately the sales slid and, you know, wasn't able to maintain itself. And,
but that one went for a pretty long time.
It did. You know, but any of these comics, it doesn't matter how much buzz that a title gets if that buzz does not translate into new readers picking it up, finding it accessible enough that they can read or see that issue that they pick up and want to read more, and thus, you know, grow the readership. And we've talked about accessibility before, and, you know, maybe that's one of the biggest drawbacks to comics, because if a title is not accessible on every issue, pretty much, someone can hear buzz about it, they can pick it up, they can read an issue, and they can say, what the heck is going on? And then put it back down, or, you know, just if they bought it, you know, not come back and buy anymore.
Or if they hear buzz about it, they go to the store and it's on part 3 of 6, oh, I'll wait till the next story arc to jump on. 3-4 months later, are they going to remember they wanted to jump on that title?
Yeah.
So I certainly think accessibility is a huge problem in comics these days. I think this is the kind of issue, though, that combats that very well, because it was a very, you know, accessible issue. And this was one where, you know, I thought the art was good, I thought the story was good. Didn't totally knock it out of the park, but this was a very solid issue. I mean, for me, it's a very good 4 out of 5, and one that, you know, has me a little disappointed that, you know, this is the second to last issue.
Yeah, I gave it a 4 out of 5 also. I think this is a great issue, like I said. One thing I really like about the series is some of the characters that it's been bringing back. You know, it was like a few issues ago they brought back Super Hip.
Mm-hmm.
And that sent me to the internet. You know, Super Hip is from The Adventures of Bob Hope Comics. It's like Bob Hope's nephew was Super Hip. And, you know, Tad Walliter Jute Fruce. You know, it's like, I was like, who the heck is Super Hip when they, you know, came back to the U.S. and, you know, Robot Man called up his buddy Super Hip, who's like an Elvis impersonator in Vegas or something, and it's like, who the heck is this guy? And then, you know, I look him up on Wikipedia, and it's like, well, sure enough, you know, Adventures of Bob Hope, number 95, is his first appearance. And, you know, that was, you know, he has the Doom Patrol tie-in, which actually I think was in a flashback panel here, because his sole appearance in the Silver Age in a non-Bob Hope comic was as a guest at the wedding of Elastigirl and Mento in Doom Patrol 104.
Yeah, and they so do have Doom, that in
yeah,
the...
Yeah, exactly. And so it makes sense for him to be here, because Doom Patrol was his only tie to the mainstream DC universe.
I think it's fun when they bring back characters like that and do it in a way where you don't really need to have read that other appearance to know what's going on, but it's like, yeah, technically he's got a history, but, you know, it's like, okay, let's just have some fun with that.
Yeah, and I mean, I've never read a Bob Hope comic in my life. I mean, those were some of the DC comics that I never really picked up. You know, they had, like, The Adventures of Bob Hope. They had the Jerry Lewis comic. And, I mean, I wasn't buying comics, I don't think, back when they were coming out in the 60s. And they're just not books that I've gone back and picked up back issues of.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Again, good issue. Great jumping on point if you want to, you know, catch either this issue or maybe this and the rest of the series, which is the following issue.
Yeah. You know. Next up, we've got The Event. Fear itself. I had nothing to fear except this issue, John.
Yeah, I had kind of mixed feelings on this one. It really was a heavy Avenger focus in terms of Steve Rogers, Thor, and Iron Man. I mean, Spidey speaks up a couple of times, but none of the other Avengers really do anything of note. It's like, okay, that's fine. But, you know, I was expecting for kind of an event series to have a little bit more of the other characters kind of actively in play. And there were just a couple of things where, I mean, there's the whole... I guess the problem I had with this issue is it didn't really do a great job setting up the theme or the intent of the event. Some Norse gods come back and return. Somehow that's kind of bad. I mean, bad enough, it, you know, slight spoiler here, it scares Odin and the Asgardians off, which I found really, really ironic, given that the whole bringing the Asgardians to Earth thing is about to go, you know, mainstream with the Thor movie, and just in time for them to have left. It's like, wow, that just seems like bad timing to me. You know, and there's the whole undercurrent of the fear being an issue or problem, but it's not really clear how or why. And that kind of had an aspect of the "he loves you" from Secret Invasion. And yeah. I felt that part of Secret Invasion never really paid off either. So there were aspects of this that, while it was a good issue and I enjoyed aspects of it, as far as selling me on the event, it kind of failed.
Well, you know, I kind of look at it as, I mean, there is a certain element of, you know, when Odin is saying, you know, something about the serpent, and he's, you know, he's coming back, and, you know, fear the serpent, or whatever the hell he was talking about. I got that mixed with the feeling of Odin is none too pleased with being on Earth, as opposed to being with the god, you know, being in Asgard, you know, above the humans. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't remember, I mean, I just could not read the Fraction Thor. I mean, I tried reading that a couple of times, and just those weird, I don't know, gods or whatever the heck they were, with the strange little cyclonic things and all their word bubbles and stuff, and, you know, combined with the Pascal fairy art, I could not read those issues. I couldn't make it through an issue, pretty much, of that. So I wasn't reading where Odin came back particularly, but I kind of gather that Odin did get brought back from Valhalla or wherever he was, and he's like none too pleased about it, because he's acting a lot more grumpy than, you know, he used to act here, and he's very much displeased with being on Earth, and it also seems that he's very much displeased in general about why he was brought back, as opposed to, you know, that he was brought back. And, you know, there were some cool moments there. I mean, I liked the gig with Odin and Thor fighting and Thor's hammer. That was like a cool moment. But, you know, just a lot of setup elements here that, I don't know, it's maybe just something that I'm getting more and more away from wanting to be teased with something, as opposed to being given some concrete info. You know what I mean? It's
well, it's like you go to a concert, and really the first thing they play should be one of their big hits to really kind of get you excited to be at the concert and going for the event, you know, kind of a thing. First issue of an event title, same thing. They need to knock it out of the park and say, wow, this is important, this is a big deal, this is exciting, because. And I didn't really feel they did that here.
I didn't really understand at the beginning, there's this riot going on, and I don't know if they explained it someplace else or what. You know, someone, I had mentioned it because I bought the issue, I got a sketch cover when it came out, and I just read Fear Itself, and I didn't have any of the ancillary titles. And I didn't understand, and someone said, oh yeah, well, you know, that's explained in Homefront number one. So then I got my DCBS shipment, and I read Homefront number one, and
I have Homefront, I have not had time to read it.
I didn't see where it was explained in Homefront number one. Maybe it's just like, it didn't seem particularly explained in Homefront number one.
Well, and the bottom line is, this is the main title for the event. We should be getting all
but,
the
I mean,
essentials
did you get,
here.
I mean, I was making an assumption that it was kind of like those New York mosque protests that are going on in the real world, you know, where they're trying to build the mosque.
It very much felt that way to me.
But they didn't come out and say it, so it's kind of like an implication. I mean, is that what it is, or is it some superhero thing that, you know, is it like they're rebuilding Avengers Mansion? Is it that, you know,
Avengers Mansion's already rebuilt? I very much took this to be the generic don't build it here for religious political reasons type squabble of some variation or another. And I don't think the specifics are really all that important. It was just kind of weird that Steve Rogers, Sharon Carter were there for what seemed to be a run-of-the-mill, you know, protests that erupted into a riot. It's like, why are they there again? You know, do you really call in? I mean, would you have called in Nick Fury for that sort of a thing? I don't think so. It just seemed a little weird.
So, anyway, I mean, I thought it was fine as an issue. It's very Thor heavy, you know, more so than Avengers heavy. It seems like it's almost like it's a Thor event. You know, it's there's all these hammers that are falling from the sky are all from the, which they don't really tell you anything about in this issue. So, you know, if you're not like reading different interviews about it, you can't even tell that it's a bunch of hammers falling from the sky. But all these things that they show near the end are all hammers falling from the sky.
Ah.
From the nine worlds of Asgard. But that's kind of like that Fear Itself prelude, where you read that and there was the hammer at the end of it. And it's like, okay, you know, what's up with that? You know, that's the hammer that Sin finds in this issue. But you still don't really know from just reading this comic what the heck it's all what that's all about. There's all kinds of information about it all over the internet. So, I mean, people who are going and reading the different interviews and stuff, you kind of have that level of information, and I think it really does change how you read the issues when you have that extra info. And I would actually say that I would prefer if instead of all these creators just going and jabbering to Newsarama and Comic Book Resources and Comics Alliance and all these people about this stuff, you know, gee, maybe you might want to put some of that information in the number one issue of the actual comic book.
Yeah.
That's just me.
Because I'm not going and looking at all those interviews and stuff. I'm judging the story based on what's in the story. And I think that's a reasonable, you know, expectation and way to go about it. And, you know, the fact those are apparently hammers at the end, I figured I'd pick up next issue and find out what they really were. There were a couple of things. I didn't think this was missing the absolute essentials of what I've got to have to understand the story, but I think that it was missing something to really sell me on the story. You know, and to me, the one quote that really jumped out as saying is kind of what I'm going to consider the hallmark of this series so far is on page 13 or 15. And that's the page where they've got Manhattan Avengers Tower and them all up on the rooftop striking a dramatic pose.
Mm-hmm.
Bottom right corner, second word bubble, first kind of phrase out of Iron Man. Let's make it an event. But yeah, let's take this story. Let's just make it a big to-do for the sake of doing it. And it's like, wow, that even made it into the issue that they're going to make it an event. It's like, wow, how subtle can you be? So
that's wit.
Really?
I think it was meant to be. Anyway. No, I get you. I mean, it's just I think it's fine, and I think, you know, as an event goes, it's just fine. It's got all the big elements. It's got the kind of stuff that is going to bring people in and read the comics. It's certainly the art was good. I really liked the art by Stuart Immonen in this issue. I think that the story itself, and again, you know, it's like since I have read a lot of these things, the story is kind of cool to some extent, but it's not in this issue. You know, it's like you read this issue, you tell me. I mean, I'm guessing that you read this issue and you really don't know what the heck this event is about and what's going on at this point.
Well, and that's what I started my whole comments with, yeah. Is something about the Norse gods. Not even totally sure which ones are returning and why that's bad, although clearly it is. And the undercurrent of fear, if that hadn't have been spelled out in the title, you know, I might have not even clued in on that. Sure, there was the guy locking the door at the end and a few things like that, but does the fear tie in with the Asgardians coming back? Does that tie into the fear? What's the cause? What's the event? Why should I care? And, I mean, really, like you said, it's very heavy on the Thor stuff, yet this seems to come out of the blue based on what I've been reading on Thor for the most part. It's very heavy on Captain America and stuff, with Sin, the daughter of the Red Skull, being a major player. It's looking like it's going to be reasonably heavy on Iron Man, because he's going to apparently rebuild Asgard. Assuming Thor's bankrolling that, since Tony's still begging for investors in his own title. But we got a ton of these other characters standing around doing nothing. So how do they factor into the story? Why do they care about this? What's going on? I mean, why is this an event versus just a big deal for a couple of characters? So yeah, there are aspects of the story that I'm sure will come out over time.
I think that Fraction could have easily put in a bit of, I mean, heck, he's got Odin talking to the Watcher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got all kinds of opportunities here. Even when Sin gets resurrected as Scotty, and she's like launching into several soliloquies as she runs around, he could have easily put into this issue what the Worthy are, and you know, what exactly is going to be happening, and kind of what the threat is to actually, you know, build up the excitement level or whatever from, you know, some point of actual information. And I think a lot of people who would listen to this podcast would also be looking at the various news sites. So, you know, that stuff is maybe not essential to them, because, you know, they kind of got that from the interviews that they read, like I did. But, you know, well, for someone who just goes into a comic book store and picks this up, I don't know, you know.
You mentioned the Worthy plural. When Sin gets the hammer, the quote is, "And he who shall be worthy will wield the hammer of Skadi." Okay, so again, like the whole Thor hammer bit, whatever. But that's singular, and, right, you know, does not, to me, connote a group, or it's a quality, not even a person, necessarily. And I'm not seeing anywhere else where the concept of the Worthy plural even shows up in this. So the fact that there's going to be, again, the bunch of people to go pick up those hammers or whatever, I'm only gathering because you're telling me.
Right, and that's what they're getting from the seven bogeys flying in from deep space, right? And they don't tell you what those are, you know. But
I was kind of more assuming people than hammers, but in the Pacific Ocean panel, it seems like it's somebody holding a hammer that's crashing down into the ocean. But again, I figured we'd get that next issue. And I guess in the next issue thing, we've got a preview of a hammer that crashed down somewhere, but if that's a big deal, that's something that should have been clearly introduced in the first issue.
Well, yeah, and the thing is it is kind of a big deal. It's kind of like the whole premise of the series. But, you know, again, it's really not here in this issue. And that's the biggest weakness of the issue to me. I mean, I thought it was fine, but I think that more information could have been in this issue.
Now, I think some people are sitting listening to the podcast right now thinking, but they mentioned this in those two-page things and months back. And it's like, well, I vaguely recall there's the Heroes of the Fear itself, and they had some stuff with some hammers, some big guys, you know, whatever. I ignored those because I want to read the story when I read the story. And anyone who will eventually pick up the trade paperback or hardcover of this off the bookstore shelf or whatever will never have seen those. So how the story starts in this issue is how it's going to start for a lot of people down the line. So I don't think it's an unreasonable expectation for the setup of the story to be in the story.
I'm going to expect that when the trade paperback ultimately comes out and you read the blurb on the back of it, it's going to have a lot more information about what that story is about than what we're being told right now.
Probably.
It's going to have more of what they've been blabbing about off in the Newsarama interviews and such. You know, they're going to be talking about, well, it's X and Y, and I don't want to ruin it for you. I mean, it's just like, it's just like, it's this and this and this and this other thing, and it's like, okay, that sounds kind of cool. you know, and then you can pick up that trade paperback and flip through it. And, you know, you're probably not going to only flip through the first 25 pages, and you're going to see some, you know, cool stuff happening later on. And then you'll say, oh, that looks like a good story. And of course you'll pick it up and buy it. And, you know, there it all is. You're not waiting months and months to have them, you know, dribble out some crumb of information to you that tells you what the deal is with the story. You know, you'll kind of, you know, okay, well, that's what the story is.
Yeah. For me, it was a 4 out of 5. It's good. It could have been better, but I didn't think it was bad. There are a couple of things that just kind of, you know, frustrated me a little here and there, but by and large, I enjoyed it. But for the 56 pages or so of story, they had the room to go put in the additional information.
Yeah, I gave it a 4 also. I think that it's, as events go, it's shaping up to be a decent event. I think that if Fraction had chosen to put the kind of information that they've been already talking on the internet for at least a month before this issue came out into this issue, it would have been a 5 out of 5 for me. But they didn't choose to do that. You know, they put into this issue what they put into this issue.
Cool.
Okay, and then our last book of the month is Non-Player Number 1 by Nate Simpson.
It'd be actually the last book of the week.
The last book of the week?
Early in the month.
Hey, man.
Yeah, this is Non-Player Number 1 of 4, and this is one I know you'd been talking up quite a bit during the solicitation cycle, and it was one of the main reasons I picked it up. Beautiful art in this issue. Really detailed, really, you know, clean style. There were a few places where, like on the cover, I think the coloring might have been a little bit more effective, but because there are a couple where it's just things get lost in the panel because there's so much detail and stuff there, and I think the coloring could have popped a few things out a little bit better. But that's a nitpick. This is one of the, you know, visually best-looking comics I've seen in a while. I'm really liking the art style here, the way it tells the story, the amount of information they fit onto a page without really crowding it. I mean, there's one page here that's got like 9 panels on it, covering quite a bit of ground, and you know, it feels comfortable. You know, it doesn't feel like, oh crap, they crammed too many panels there or whatever. Story-wise, I thought this was a really good story. There were a couple things that were a little unclear, but no doubt will be explained as the story progresses, and I'm okay with that. Except for the fact that, unfortunately, no future issues have actually been solicited yet. Yeah. I haven't looked at the May solicitations yet to know if it'll be in there, but that kind of frustrates me because that means it's going to be many, many months before we get part 2 of this.
Yeah, and it's not for lack of working on it. It's just, and, you know, when I interviewed Nate, this is one of the things I brought up. I'm like, man, you got a lot of detail in here. How long does it take you to draw a page of this thing? And he's like, oh, it takes me several days. You know, I was like, oh, I told him, you got to come up with, I mean, I love the art, but boy, you got to come up with a way of drawing faster. Because, you know, I'm guessing it's not because he's got other things to do. He's working on this book, but it just takes him a long time to do these pages because he's doing the whole thing. You know, he's doing the pencil, he's doing the ink, he's doing the color, he's putting the letters in. I mean, this is him, the whole thing from start to finish.
And I respect that.
You know, and that's something that is, on one hand, very cool. You know, it's like his complete creative vision. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, there's only so many hours in a day for the guy to get it done. And, you know, it's taken him 4 or 5 months to put out an issue of this book. You know, I just hope that when the next issue comes out, he's got a recap on the inside of the front cover that's, you know, it's like, what has gone before? And, you know, that would be a good time to put out, reprint of issue number 1. Again, for people who didn't get it.
I think he would have been better served by hanging on to the material until he could have released it, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 in rapid succession, or at least timely succession. Because it's one of those things where, as great as I think this issue is, you know, by the time we see the next one, which might be in the June solicitations, because I just checked the May while you were talking there, and it's not listed. So it'd be in the June. That means it would be, what, August. Before it could come out? That's a long, long time away. And, you know, all the story momentum and buzz he'll have gotten from this will have long since evaporated and been replaced by three or four other things, you know?
Yeah.
So
I agree with you there, and I think it's unfortunate because it's one of the most visually impactful comics I've read in a year. You know, it's a cool story, too, and I think that talking about it doesn't do it justice because I know I was at the comic shop, and I, you know, because the story, for people who didn't listen to the previous interview, it's set in the future. And the game technology and just technology in general has progressed to the point where the MMO, the massively multiplayer online games that people play, they can kind of jack into them where you kind of feel like you're actually in the environment. It's almost like it seems like it's like a virtual reality kind of environment when you're playing the game. And the main character, she's an assassin type of character in the game, and she ends up killing the wife of one of the big bad guy or big non-player characters, and that's non-player in the title, but she kills the wife of one of the big NPCs in the game right around the time when the NPCs kind of gain sentience in an AI sort of fashion. And that's going to play into the story. Now, you get that. You get some of her existence in the real world where she delivers tamales. One of the things I thought was really cool was how she kind of applies that life skin at the end, mm-hmm. where it like alters her perception of reality. So instead of seeing this kind of run down, dilapidated cityscape with graffiti and stuff, she sees the world of her game, you know, and like people, you know, just regular people look like, you know, elves, and, you know, cars look like creatures and all other kinds of cool stuff. It's just like an interesting idea of, you know, an application of technology.
Now, the whole bit about the non-player characters being sentient was kind of teased at, hinted at as a possibility, but not stated as such in this issue. So that's another case where, you know, here's a creator going on an interview, in this case with us, giving out information that's not in the first issue. So, and that again is frustrating in so much as there's no second issue solicited yet. One of the things I will say is using the massively multiplayer game in this manner gives this property a very interesting blend of the science fiction and fantasy realms. You know, with the science fiction virtual and augmented reality providing the mechanism for that fantasy setting, which I think really kind of sets this apart from most of the other stuff out there. Because it's not often you get kind of that nice blend of the science fiction and fantasy working so well together. And again, I'm looking forward to future issues, but, you know, it's going to be a long time in coming, and hopefully when they solicit, I won't forget that I really like this issue and, you know, we'll remember to order the next issue.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to assume that they're going to be putting out second prints and third prints of this like they did with Morning Glory so people can pick it up. One thing I found interesting on this issue was how fast it sold out for real in the comic shops. You know, you see a lot of press releases, well, I do anyway, about books that are sellouts, you know, and I'm making air quotes right now with my fingers, which you can't see listening to me, because, you know, the sellout is that it's sold out from Diamond. And, you know, realistically, it's not hard to make a book a sellout from Diamond because you print to order. I mean, shops order these books months in advance, and if you get people that pre-order 10,000 copies of the book, if you print 10,000 copies of the book and maybe an extra 500 to account for damages and stuff, you know, it's going to be a sellout. So a sellout in that respect is not that special. in my mind.
Well, if anything, it's a show of lack of faith by the publisher.
Yeah. What is actually interesting is when you can't find the book on the rack. I mean, I don't know how many books that I see these things come across, you know, sell out, we're rushing back for a second printing. And I go into the local comic shop, and there's copies of it sitting there to buy.
Yeah, but whenever they rush back to a second printing, that's because they actually have enough back orders where retailers are saying, I need more. Diamond is saying, well, we need to get a threshold amount to be able to place another order. They actually get that amount, place it with the publisher. So while your retailer may have plenty on hand, apparently there are enough other retailers that don't, that need copies. Now, in an ideal world, you know, the stores stuck with the extra copies would be able to just basically say, here, use these instead, you know, and not wind up with a second printing that was just misallocated, but had the essentially right number in the first printing.
Yeah, I guess my point is that when somebody sees something on a news site that says the book is sold out, that doesn't necessarily mean that you won't be able to find it at your local comic shop.
Right, because
you know, you should check with your local comic shop, because it may very well still be copies at the shop. Now, in the case of Non-Player, every place that I looked, they sold out of this book within the first 2 hours of being open. And the difference here is, because I've been kind of watching this, I go at lunchtime on Wednesday to the shop, and what I found interesting to watch when Non-Player came out, people would walk up, they would pick up, you know, because the shop I go to's got the rack of comics there, and, you know, the big long wall of comics. And, you know, for new books, you know, they got like new this week tags, and, you know, check this one out or whatever. So people were going, they would pick up Non-Player, they would flip through it, and they would add it to their stack. There are lots of other number one issues and, you know, books that I saw people would pick up, they would flip through it, and they would put it back on the rack. And to me, that's an indication of the why art, you know, it's like comics are a visual medium, right? And certain art styles are going to appeal more to some people than to other people. And then certain styles seem like, you know, they have kind of a niche kind of audience that, you know, some people will think that it looks really great and other people will really not resonate with it. Other art styles, like the style in Non-Player, seems to be more of a universal style, where I haven't really heard anyone that I've talked to say, yeah, I'm not too big on the art. You know, so much everyone who's looked at it said, wow, that's pretty cool art. And I think that's a selling point for it, because when somebody picks it up and flips through it, that's what they see. And they buy it. You know, now it's the matter of, they're going to read it. Are they going to want another issue? But to your point, they want another issue, and that other issue is not there.
Yeah.
You know, and what's our lag effect going to be, and, you know, on that second issue, and, you know, how is the second issue going to do? You know, so I hope the best for him, because it's a great book, and I know I'll be buying, you know, the second issue when it comes out, whenever it comes out. But
we should just be sure to make it a pick for
the
preview spotlight, because it's one that I really think kind of is going to need that extra push to remind people.
Yeah.
Because for me, this was a very clear 5 out of 5. This was an excellent book. I love the art. I think people who flip through it on the rack see, hey, it looks like good art, I'll give it a shot. When they actually read it, are going to be really impressed by the really good story.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And the other part about it is, you know, I asked my comic shop owner, I said, hey, did you check out Non-Player when I was buying my books that week? And he's like, yeah, you know, I looked at it. It was, you know, it looked really great, but I'm not really into MMOs. So I didn't like the subject matter. And I said, well, did you read it? Because it's really not, you know, like some comics about MMOs, you know, like you get World of Warcraft comic or something, you know, it's probably more like if you don't play the MMO or AMMO, you're not going to want to read the comic. And this one, I think that's a framing device or kind of a story element, but it's not about the MMO. You know, it's not like you have to be an MMO fan to like this comic.
I would equate it to like the first Matrix movie.
Yeah.
You know, and if you liked that or liked any of the high points of the Matrix series and, you know, are willing to kind of ignore where the parts you didn't like. I mean, all the good parts about that are there are similar good parts to non-player. Again, right. the other reality, the, you know, maybe they'll be able to bend the rules, maybe they won't, but it's a very good premise.
Yeah. So I gave it obviously a 5 out of 5 also. Again, one of the most visually stunning comics I've seen in a long time, and just I'm really enjoying the story as well. So looking forward to number 2 whenever it comes out.
Yeah, same here.
Now, one thing I wanted to bring up is Joe Casey's Butcher Baker, The Righteous Maker. This book is one that I've been enjoying, but it's kind of the art style in it is one of those art styles that some people are going to really gravitate towards, and I think other people are not going to gravitate towards. So it can, you know, and also the subject matter, it's a mature reader's book that's like actually, you know, there's a lot of violence and other kinds of stuff in it that, you know, it's not for kids. What I find more interesting about this book than the actual comic is this is one of these books where the creator, in this case Joe Casey, has kind of a really long set of back matter. You know, in this case it's, you know, like about, you know, 6 pages with some diagrams and pictures and stuff, but it's more like, you know, kind of like an editorial slash rant. And he had something that was very interesting in this issue that I read it right after I had made a similar post online that I thought was very applicable, because I've been thinking about it a lot, and it's more about the art of comics. And when I say the art of comics, I don't mean the physical art, more the art form of comics. And let me point it out, because I think Joe kind of was channeling my thoughts exactly lately. And he starts out, he says, I love me some superheroes. Love them. Marvel and DC superheroes. I grew up on a healthy diet of both of them. I read Avengers, Iron Man, Daredevil, Thor, Fantastic Four, Captain America, X-Men, New Teen Titans, JLA, Batman, Superman, Flash, Green Lantern. I was definitely a hardcore reader. These characters got me hooked into the medium, and for that, I'm forever grateful. But in hindsight, I consider them to be a gateway to something much larger, the art of comic books. And, you know, he kind of goes on, you know, to talk more about that. And it's kind of how I feel, too. You know, it's like I started out reading just the superhero comics, and I still love the superhero comics. But, you know, they kind of opened my eyes, and then he goes on, you know, he's like naming, you know, as some of the other comics, you know, like Nexus, Badger, Star Slayer, John Sable, Love and Rockets, Journey, Cerebus, Mage, Grendel, Rocketeer, American Splendor, Bacchus, Martial Law, Mouse, Concrete, and he names a whole bunch more, you know, and he talks about the difference between someone who's writing stories for a character that they don't own, where they are contributing to the mythos, and ones that are creating something new that would not exist if they did not create it from whole cloth, and that's the creator-owned books. And, you know, that's I just found it very fascinating, because, you know, it's like, you know, you're always going to have Superman and Batman. And I like Superman and Batman. I like a good Superman and Batman story, you know. But, you know, and it's like I like Thor. You know, there's going to be Thor comics, whether Matt Fraction writes them or not. You know, there's going to be, you know, Avengers after Brian Bendis stops writing Avengers. You know, but when you have a creator-owned property that is the creative vision of somebody, it's kind of tied to that person. I mean, you've read Concrete, right?
Yeah.
I love Concrete. Concrete is coming back in Dark Horse Presents, and I'm so excited because you haven't seen a Concrete story in 10 years or something from Paul Chadwick. I loved Concrete. You know, Paul Chadwick created Concrete. There would be no Concrete if there was not Paul Chadwick. And, you know, it's something to look forward to that Paul Chadwick's going to do another Concrete. It's not like you got, you know, it's like when I read Batman, right? I mean, there's some Batman stories I like, and there are some Batman stories like, you know, that one wasn't that much to my liking, you know, but it's kind of off, you know, on the side of, you know, something, you know, somebody created that story, someone wrote it, but, you know, when you have something that is the creative vision of a creator, I think they kind of shepherd it, you know, a certain way and kind of hold it. I don't know.
I guess the things that kind of pop in my mind as you were saying all that was there seems to be, and I'm not saying necessarily in this case, but I've noticed this kind of overall in comics, a sense sometimes that somehow the superhero genre is somehow inferior to other things. And I always find that a little frustrating because you can tell a good story and the window dressing could be superheroes, it could be mystery, it could be science fiction, it could be slice of life, and you can still tell the same story and the same quality story regardless of the genre. So I know there's a lot with the creators feeling like they're kind of pinned in of, well, I can either sell something so it's got a superhero stuff so it'll sell, or I can do something else and it won't sell because it's not superheroes. And I get that frustration. But that's not a fault of the genre so much as the way the market evolved.
Right.
And likewise, you know, particularly in this case, there seems to be a higher value placed on creator-owned material versus, you know, shared universe or enhancing existing properties. And I certainly agree we need good creator-owned stuff. I think Non-Player this week is an excellent example of something that did not exist before, you know, Nate Simpson went and created it. We need that. But I think we have also seen cases, what Hickman's doing on Fantastic Four, what Geoff Johns has done over the last couple of years with Green Lantern and stuff, where somebody working on an existing property is breathing new life, new material, and really expanding that and doing some great stuff there too. And that whenever I hear a creator kind of bemoaning, you know, it's corporate-owned superheroes, you know, and that's bad, both the corporate-owned and the superhero stuff, and, you know, if it's true art or true whatever, it's got to be non-superhero, it's got to be creator-owned. It's if somehow the genre and the ownership is somehow the underlying problem with quality in comics or the sales of comics.
Well, I can see how that can be interpreted. The way I choose to interpret it is that, as you say, there's nothing that intrinsically makes superheroes inferior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can tell really good superhero stories. I think that the problem comes in when the custodians of these superheroes lower the bar and allow so much weak material to be published that's just trading on the name.
And that I agree with, and that's bad.
And that's what the issue is, because I think the point is that, you know, Paul Chadwick, he chooses not to just let any Joe Blow come out and do concrete stories that are going to diminish the character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas if they think that they can sell an extra couple of Spider-Man comics by putting out something that's not a brilliant comic, well, they will put out some not so brilliant comics. And, you know, when you look at it kind of percentage wise, that's when you get into the problems. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. There are really great superhero comics. I think that kind of every year when you see, you know, the Eisner Award nominations, because there's generally way fewer superhero type of stories nominated than just other kinds of books. And it kind of diminishes, as you say, you know, that, well, if it's a superhero book, you can't have a good superhero book. I don't think that's true, but I think that separating the wheat from the chaff in the superhero genre is a little more difficult.
Well, if only because there's so much more material there.
Exactly.
I mean, it would be like as if TV people, TV fans and stuff were saying that the mystery genre is the source of all problems in television. Because, you know, you look at those crappy Saturday morning cartoons, so many of which were mystery shows like Scooby-Doo and what, and how they just totally, you know, shown it was least common denominator. You look at the primetime shows, so many of them are mystery shows of one ilk or another. It's the bane of their existence. Can't we do something other than mystery shows? And there might be some merit to that. But there's nothing to say you can't do a really good mystery show either. You know, and I think we've seen quite a few on TV that do that.
Like Castle is a really good mystery show.
Castle, Endgame. I'm sure I could name a couple others if I gave it a little thought and stuff. I mean, there are a lot of new twists, a lot of fun things you could do with that. Now, I don't think we're seeing necessarily that level of creativity, inventiveness necessarily being applied to the superhero stuff. And the other key difference worth pointing out is Castle is indeed a new property. It's not like they're continuing doing, you know, Magnum PI episodes, you know, 30 years later or what have you. You know, whereas we're still getting the same characters by and large in a lot of the mainstream superhero books.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's not the genre, but the stagnation we're seeing in evolution of the characters, the properties, the stuff over in the corporate superhero arena.
Right.
And I think if some of these people who are, you know, doing these kind of tirades and stuff, and again, I get the frustration, particularly on the creator side, of feeling they can either do what they really want to do and tell a great story there, or, well, I got to shoehorn it into a superhero universe so it'll sell. That's got to be very frustrating. But if they were to think a little harder, dig a little deeper as to what the real problems are, and not just stop at corporate-owned superhero, they could actually get to the root of the problem and maybe actually, you know, instigate some change that would fix things and make some of these things just sell better.
Yeah. But, you know, I think the talent pool that is being drawn from, you know, can't put out 90 really great comic books every month from Marvel. You know, it's like, but they put out 90 comic books every month. And, you know, that's where it comes into, you know, the issue. You know, if they said, okay, you know what, we're going to put out 40 comics and they're all going to be really damn good comics. And maybe, you know, quality, you know, there's a certain subjective nature to it. But, you know, boy, I just can't help but think that my worldview is not so far different than somebody else, than everybody else's, that, you know, like, for instance, I'm not a personal fan of X-Force, right? Uncanny X-Force by Rick Remender. I've tried reading some issues. You know, I read the 5.1 issue. I read the first issue. I don't care for it, but I look at that comic and I see that it's a well-done comic, right? Mm-hmm. I don't personally, it's not my personal cup of tea, but I can see that it's a well-done comic. You know, there are other comics that I look at and it's like, this just doesn't seem well done. And, you know, it doesn't seem like it's not my cup of tea thing. It seems like there are story mechanic problems here. And, you know, it's like, are the people who are editing and art directing and all these kind of things at these companies, are they so far off kilter from where my worldview is that they think that's actually good? You know, I've been at cons, at panels where, you know, the marketing guy will throw up a slide and say, look at the great art on this. You know, and again, art is subjective, but I mean, I'll look at it and I'm like, really?
Yes. I think art and story are subjective. However, I think you could go through the bestseller, you know, comics and trades, or just the comics, we'll say, because the trades are usually just compilations of that. But on the comics side, the bestsellers, look at the top artists and stuff like that. And whether you agree that they're good artists or not, they sell well. So from a marketing standpoint, by definition, that becomes good art. And that they could learn from that, see what's common amongst those, and, you know, not be trying to foist out some, you know, style that's so off the mark from that, as to be something that people would flip through and the majority of people would just put it back on the rack. You know, so I think there is a objective measure that could be applied to this subjective matter of art and story. And I question if the marketing people at some of these companies are doing that.
Yeah. But anyway, I mean, it seemed like an interesting, you know, concept. It's just Butcher Baker, Righteous Maker, I think is a great comic. I can see that this is not the cup of tea of a lot of people. And, you know, in fact, this is one that, you know, while I saw non-player people would pick it up off the rack, look at it, and put it in their stack, I saw a bunch of people pick up Butcher Baker, flip through it, and put it right back instead of putting it in their stack, you know? And again, it's that kind of a difference. It's just like, it's not hitting the same as broad of an audience. Doesn't mean it's not a good comic, right? It just means that it's not got the same wide appeal.
Well, just to use that as a potential benchmark, on the assumption that what you saw at that one time at that one store has any bearing, you know, universally, that first issue of Butcher Baker, Righteous Maker sold 7,637 copies through the direct market to retailers. Now, how many are sitting on shelves? How many sold to readers? We don't know. But if that art was not as universally appealing as we think the art Non-Player is, then we should see potentially really good sales for Non-Player, provided enough units made it into stores. And really, in both of these cases, they were kind of ordered blind other than what was in previews.
Right.
And that comes down to how well do these people solicit books.
But when you get down into image numbers, you know, it's hard for that kind of thing to apply, because I think that any kind of niche thing, you know, you're going to appeal, you know, you potentially can appeal to a good, you know, 10,000, you know, 12,000 people with any kind of a niche thing. Because, you know, I think that's, I think if they would have taken a bigger risk on Non-Player,
it would have worked out better. Yeah,
it would have worked out better. I mean, I talked to my comic shop guy, and he said, I said, well, how many copies did you order? And he said, well, over and above the pull list, I ordered 30 copies for the rack. And that's actually a lot for a first issue image comic by a creator that's never done a comic before.
Mm-hmm.
And it sold out in 2 hours in his shop. You know, so could he have sold 50? Could he have sold 60? Who knows? You know, and I'm sure there are lots of comic shops in this country that did not order a single copy of that comic. So yep. People never saw that book and were never able to pick it up and say, oh, I'm going to add that to my stack.
So anything else, or does that pretty much do it?
I think it does it for me.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Red Robin number 22 from DC, Journey into Mystery number 622 from Marvel, and Broken Trinity Pandora's Box number 6 from Image Top Cow.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.